is Jesus is going to be displaying his power over several different kinds of things, nature, demons, disease, and death. And what would have been the Jewish expectation of what they wanted the Messiah to have power over? Rome. And so here he's showing that he's more of a cosmic king, and he's not here to solve some socio-political sort of problem. He's doing something that's much deeper and much significant for mankind across history, and not for one particular moment in history with a nation and another nation and stuff like that. So we're going to talk about some of that this morning. Let's go ahead and start with a word of prayer before we get into our text for this morning. Gracious Father, we're so thankful to you that in your great wisdom that you've designed this plan for your son to come here and to teach us and to retrain us on what our priorities ought to be, and for the possibility of us being forgiven if we choose to allow Jesus to come into our hearts and to submit to him. We thank you that he's a gracious king. We thank you for the good news that you've sent the perfect king into this world, and help us to put our confidence in him and not in any nation or principality or power that is doomed to fail. Thank you so much for these times that we can study these things together, and it's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen. All right, here's the schedule of where we're going. If you guys have the material, which I didn't print out enough of, and then I just haven't continued printing them out, so I'm sorry about that, but that is where we're going. So, Lord willing, next week we'll look at almost at all of chapter 6. But this is one of my favorite sections in the Gospel of Mark that we're looking at. But just to remind us of the overall picture of the Gospel of Mark, you can remember the Gospel of Mark with two words. The first 8 chapters showing you that Jesus is the king. Chapters 9 through 16 showing you that the king has to go to the cross. Can anybody remind us so far of what we've seen in the Gospel of Mark showing Jesus to be the king? What kingly imagery have we seen of Jesus so far? Yeah, they got the coronation ceremony. Every king's got to have like this coronation where he's anointed or appointed to be the king. And that happened when he was baptized and he receives the Spirit. And then the Father declares that this is my son. What other kingly imagery have we seen? John the Baptist is the guy that's rolling out the red carpet and preparing the way for the king. In the ancient world, whenever there was a king that was going to visit a village or a town, they would literally go and level the roads. If there was a pothole, they would fill it in. If there was part of the road that was too high, they would level it down. And so John the Baptist is kind of embodying that imagery, saying in a metaphorical way that he's trying to get people's hearts ready for the king to come, which happens by repentance, and that's what he was doing. Any other kingly kind of imagery that we've seen so far? Jesus has talked about the kingdom has come, so that's pretty clear kind of language as well. We're going to see some things about his power in this section. And so the outline of what we're looking at, chapter 4, verse 35 through 41 is going to show him calming the storm. There's 3 boat stories in the Gospel of Mark. There's this one, there's the one he walks on water, and then in chapter 8 where Jesus is questioning the disciples about their lack of faith, and he's reminding them about how he fed them with the 5,000 and then the 4,000 and the loaves that they had left over. Every one of the boat stories in the Gospel of Mark does something to especially challenge the faith of the disciples. Well, I'll say more about that whenever we get to more of those boat stories. All right, chapter 5, verses 1 through 20 is going to be this guy that has this demon possession problem. Perhaps up to 2,000 demons are in this guy. And then you've got another sandwich story where there's 2 healings that are kind of put together in one text. Now, what we're going to see throughout this section is that there's going to be 4 different problems that nobody other than Jesus can solve. So, for example, the storm, there's the sailors can't stop the storm. Only Jesus can do that. The guy that has the demon possession, there's society's trying to like shackle this guy and bind this guy and put him aside to different places. He finally encounters Jesus, and Jesus is actually able to root out the problem and not just shackle the guy. And then in chapter 5, the end of the chapter, there's no doctor that can solve disease or death. So in all of these stories, Jesus is the one that's overcoming problems that the strongest of humanity can't overcome. So there's something different about this guy, clearly. Something else to say about the flow of thought, what we've been looking at. In chapter 4, where Jesus is preaching and teaching in parables, there were four parables in chapter 4, and in the next couple sections, you've got four miracles that he does. So four parables, and then after that is four miracles. And in every one of these miracles, there's something that somebody's afraid of, but after Jesus performs the miracle, they're more afraid of Jesus than the thing they were originally afraid of. So let me show you how this works in this text. So in chapter 4, verse 41, after Jesus calms the storm, it says, and they were filled with great fear after the storm was calmed. In chapter 5, verse 15, after the demon-possessed guy has been healed of his demon possession, it says, they came to Jesus and saw the demon-possessed man, the one who had had the legion sitting there clothed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. So it seems like they have greater fear after they see that Jesus could heal this guy. In chapter 5, verse 33, but the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came in fear and trembling and fell down before him and told the whole truth. And then also in chapter 5, verse 42, and immediately the girl got up and began walking, for she was about 12 years of age, and they were immediately overcome with amazement. So amazement or fear. You see that idea that there's so many things in this life that we could be afraid of. But if God were to just come and solve the problem right then and there, would that solve our fear problem? It would just shift it to the thing we should be afraid of, and that's God. There's a lot to say about that. We'll probably touch on that as we go through this. One other thing to say about the flow of thought of this bigger section here. After these four displays of Jesus' miraculous power, chapter 6 shows, like, it comes to a screeching halt with rejecting Jesus and his disciples. Or John the Baptist, I guess, specifically. So in chapter 6, Jesus is going to go to his hometown, and he gets rejected in his hometown. He sends out his disciples, and in all of that, John the Baptist has been executed. So it's like you see this great power, and the sorrow and the sadness you should feel for how he's being rejected in the very next section. So that's just some things about the overall flow of thought. Anything you guys want to say about any of that before we get into the first story with calming the storm? Does that make sense? I like to try to see like bigger picture things and then like smaller, bigger picture things to dial down to what we're looking at right now. So, okay, let's look at Jesus calming the storm. So Mark chapter 4, verses 35 to 41. On that day when evening had come, he said to them, "Let us go across to the other side." And leaving the crowd, they took him with them in the boat just as he was, and others were with him. And a great, notice the word great in this text, a great windstorm arose, and the waves were breaking into the boat so that the boat was already filling. But he was in the stern, asleep on the cushion, and they awoke him and said, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" And he awoke and rebuked the wind and the sea and said, "Peace, be still." And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. He said to them, "Why are you so afraid? Have you still no faith?" They were filled with great fear and said to one another, "Who is this that even the wind and the sea obey him?" All right. As we get into this, maybe one thing to point out at the beginning here, what was the Israelite or the Old Testament view of water, the sea, the ocean? How would they view those things? That's kind of a broad question, but what do you guys think? Yeah, it's terrifying. We can't really control it. What else? Who could control it in the Bible? God. So where are the times in the Bible where God did have some kind of ability to harness the water? The Red Sea crossing, where else? Crossing the Jordan in Joshua 3 and 4. The flood, very good. And then you also have the Spirit of God hovering over the face of the deep in creation. So the Old Testament perspective of water is that the only thing that can control it is God. And then you also have passages like Psalm 107, verse 29. He made the storm be still and the waves of the sea were hushed, referring to God. There's other passages in the Old Testament, like in Job, that talks about God's power over water. And so when Jesus is going to calm this storm by rebuking it with his words, And it calms, and then they ask this question, who is this? This is one of the boat stories where they're learning something deeper about the nature of God. That's what these boat stories do in the Gospel of Mark. But I want to bring up one thing that I think is especially interesting about this story, and then like drill a little bit deeper here. There are details in this text that add nothing to the story. And I'm not saying that in any kind of like sacrilegious kind of way, because there's a point to be made from this. But in verse 35, it says, when evening had come. I don't know why it matters terribly for the sake of the story what time of the day this was. Maybe you could make some minor points from that, but it's not a huge point to make. Another detail is that it says that he was in the, that they left in verse 36 just as he was. Anybody know what that means? What had he been doing in chapter 4? Where was he teaching from? Remember, look at chapter 4, verses 1 and 2. Yeah, he was in the boat while he was teaching. So people were swarming to try to get to him. He gets into the boat to create a distance so that they become captive audience. They have to listen to what he says because nobody's going to get to him on the boat. So he, like, when it says he left just as he was, it's saying he didn't go back to the shore at all to get anything. Just as he was from where he was teaching, he just stays there. So I don't know why that detail matters. Here's another one. There were other boats with him. Did you know that before that? I don't. Why does that matter? I'm not sure. Here's another one. He's in the stern, sleeping on the cushion. Why does it matter that he's in the stern, and why specifically the cushion? So one point to make from this is that the only reason you'd have details like this is if it was an eyewitness testimony. So anybody know what the first novel that was written was? Is Mary in here? What was the first novel that was written? Like, there's some novels started to get written like the 1700s, maybe some before that. You had some poems and stuff like that. Yeah, do you know?
It has nothing with your question. It's about the, on the verse 35, about the evening has come.
Yeah.
I'm not an expert in that, but my understanding is when the evening came there at the sea, it was a calmer time.
Oh, really?
And this was the calm of the day. Because remember, they fished a lot at night.
That's right, yeah.
And so this was the calm time of the day.
So it's unexpected to have
a
storm.
So it's unexpected.
That makes sense. That's good. So the modern novel has, like, you know, his hair was black, jet black, and he had piercing blue eyes and all that. You know, like, you have these vivid details of people. That did not exist in the ancient world, that kind of writing. So if you read Homer's Odyssey or Homer's Iliad, or you go and read even some of the plays from the 1600s, you're not going to have like a lot of details. You kind of have to fill them in with your mind. But in the modern novel, you've got a lot more details added in the story. And so in the ancient world, one of the ways that you knew that this story actually happened is if you've got details like this, and you can imagine Peter talking to Mark, and Peter's telling Mark, yeah, I remember when we were in the boat, and this is how it all was, and Mark's writing this down. This is the way in the ancient world that you would show that it was an eyewitness event. Does that make sense? All right, so that's just one bigger thing to say about this text. All right, so in verses 35 to 38, you've got this sudden storm, and like LR said, it would have been very unexpected at this time of the day. And during the storm, what's Jesus doing? He's sleeping. We're going to come back to that in a little bit. When the disciples say, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" Who would be included in that "we"? Jesus, I think. I think they're going to Jesus, and they're like, "Dude, like, do you not see that we're all about to die? And like, can you get up and try to get some of the water out?" I don't know what exactly they're expecting him to do. But what Jesus does is he, in this text, he rebukes two things. The first thing that he rebukes is the sea. And does the sea listen? The sea listens to him. Can you imagine that? Like, they're in the boat. The boat's rocking. There's water getting in. And then Jesus is like, stop it, storm. And then boom, it's all like glassy calmness. And if you were in the boat with the disciples, can you imagine why they would be filled with great fear? I mean, if you were around somebody that could do that, what else could he do? Who is this guy? So he can control the water just by telling it, but he rebukes the disciples, and this is what I want to spend the most time on. So the sea is listening to Jesus. The disciples evidently have been struggling to listen to something, because what does Jesus rebuke them with regards to? Their faith. Okay, so let's think about this. Where does faith come from? Hearing. And hearing what? The word of God. Okay, so how could Jesus fairly be criticizing their faith here? What did he ever say that should make them know that they weren't going to die? Yes, this is so cool. So in chapter 4, do you remember one of the words that is used all throughout chapter 4? He's saying, listen, hear. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. The whole chapter has been about how well are you paying attention to everything that I say. And then there's only one set of red letters in this story. And then you got Jesus saying, peace be still to the water. But look at verse 35. What did Jesus say to the disciples? He said, let us go to the other side. So he said that. Does that mean that they're going to go to the other side? If he said it, and so this is my take on what's happening with this story here, is that after this chapter filled with, listen, 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 he who has ears to hear, the measure that you use, it's going to be measured back to you. All of these challenges on how well we're paying attention. And then the chapter ends with a test. Are you guys listening? Because we said we were going to go to the other side, and then you look at the storm and you go, oh, we're going to die! And he said, we're going to get to the other side. So one point to make from this that I think is really important is that in our life, storms, like calamity, trials, can they ever distract us from what Jesus has said? And the promises that he's made? I mean, how many times have you gone through some kind of like health crisis or potential problem financially or this kind of problem or whatever, and you're starting to like question, are we going to even make it to the other side? Are we going to be okay? And ultimately, yes, we will make it to the other side and be with God forever. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and they've also seen the healings too. I mean, despite the sermon that he's been preaching.
Right.
It's kind of like, I'm healed. You think I have limitless power here? Come on.
Right.
I've seen what I've done.
Right, just by even looking at even if he never said, let us go to the other side, they should have deduced by now that he could do something about this. So, and then of course they ask this question, who is this? All right, so this is a pretty familiar story, but have you guys noticed the connections and the relationship that this scene has with the book of Jonah? Start throwing them out there. What similarities or differences do you see with this story and the book of Jonah? They're on water? What was that?
Sleeping in the boat.
Okay, so we got sleeping in a boat during a storm. What else?
As soon as
right, so both of them did something to accomplish the calming of the water, right? The boaters, the sailors, they wake Jonah and Jesus up to try to do something about the storm. And so both Jonah was sacrificed to calm the storm. Jesus is going to do something later to sacrifice himself to calm the greater storm. Did you have something? All right. But here's one really cool contrast that I didn't learn until this last week. So when Jonah was in the boat sleeping, why was he in the boat? Running from God and running from what ethnicity? Gentiles. Look at chapter 5. Where Jesus gets to the other side of the water, and where is he? What territory is he in chapter 5, verse 1? Gadarene. Is that Gentile or Jewish region? This is a Gentile region. So, Jonah was fleeing from Gentiles. Jesus is fleeing or running to the Gentiles. So it's almost like he's reversing the wickedness of Jonah and being like the perfected Jonah in this story. So I just think that's really cool. That might be like a Bible nerd kind of thing. Anything you guys want to say about any of that, though? Yeah. Yep.
If the ones that he was talking to had the faith he wished they had, they wouldn't be worried about going to the other side.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
That would be agreeing that the other side would be happy.
Right. Good. Anything else? All right, so this gets us into chapter 5, where we'll spend the rest of this class. Before we leave this, you can make this into a metaphor that, like, the other side for us would be being with God forever, and the distractions that we have in this life filled with turmoil could make us think and lose sight of where we're ultimately going. But we will make it to the other side if we have faith in him and all that. So, okay. So chapter 5. Let me show you three main things that get repeated and threaded throughout the totality of chapter 5. So in chapter 5, you're going to see three times people falling at Jesus' feet. You see it with the Gerasene demoniac in verse 6. You see the synagogue ruler who's got a daughter that's close to death. You've got this woman that's been bleeding for 12 years. All three of them in those verses fall down before Jesus, acknowledging something about his power and his authority, perhaps understanding a little bit more than the disciples just were in the boat. Throughout the chapter, several times, you have people begging or imploring Jesus to do something. So in verse 7 and in verse 12, the demons are going to be begging Jesus for something. In verse 17, the herdsmen, the people that live in this region where this guy was healed, they're begging Jesus to leave. You've got the man who had the demons begging to come with Jesus. In verse 23, you've got Jairus coming to Jesus, begging him to heal his daughter. So that's another thing that's repeated throughout the whole chapter. Another one that's even more prominent throughout the whole chapter is Jesus interacting with uncleanness. There's all kinds of unclean things in this chapter. So Jesus is in an unclean region because it's Gentile territory. There's an unclean spirit in this man that he encounters. He's living in the unclean tombs, which gets repeated more than any of the other things in verses 2, 3, and 5. There's unclean pigs in the area. There's this woman that has this unclean bleeding, menstrual bleeding, that she's had for 12 years in Leviticus that would make her unclean. And then there's a dead body that would also make somebody unclean. All right. Can you guys think of any, like, why have all of these ideas repeated? What's the relationship between all of these ideas?
Christ can cure
all of these things. And, Jesus is able to conquer uncleanness. People are recognizing his authority and his ability to do those kinds of things. But in this chapter, you get this like ominous kind of like, oh, it's so unclean. And it's so, what would it mean that you couldn't do if you became unclean in the Old Testament? You couldn't worship. You couldn't approach God. So is Jesus the temple, though? So Jesus is the temple. He says that he is in John chapter 2. So it's kind of weird that if somebody was unclean, they couldn't go to the temple, but what is the temple doing here? Going to uncleanness and, like, solving those problems. So it's just a really cool kind of reversal of what you'd expect. The question in the Old Testament was, who can go to the temple? Who can go to the temple? And then in the New Testament, the temple is going out to that which is unclean and healing it. So there's just so much to say about all that, but we don't have time. All right, look at this story with the Gerasene demoniac. Look what happens in chapter 5, verses 1 through 5 to get started here. They came to the other side of the sea, to the country of the Gerasenes. Your version might say the Gadarenes. And when Jesus had stepped out of the boat, immediately there met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit. He lived among the tombs, and no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain, for he had often been bound with shackles and chains, but he wrenched the chains apart, and he broke the shackles in pieces. No one had the strength to subdue him. Night and day among the tombs and on the mountains, he was always crying out and cutting himself with stones. All right. Can you imagine being the disciples here? And like, oh, we're going to die in the water. Like, whoa, this guy. And then they get to the other side, and I imagine it's like misty, like kind of ominous, like the moonlit. Maybe the sun's starting to come up. They get to the other side. Who does it say in this text gets out of the boat? The text only says that Jesus gets out of the boat, and you look at all the other accounts of this, it only says Jesus got out of the boat. Now, does that mean that the disciples got out too? I don't know. Just for the sake of imagining it, imagine that the disciples, like, they get to the other side, and they see this guy coming. They stay in the boat, and Jesus is walking out towards the guy. Now, I don't know if you've got, like, a list of non-Christian friends or family that you want to teach the gospel to, But if you knew this guy, would he be at the top of your potential conversion list? This would be like the last guy that you'd think would ever get to understand who God is. What kind of descriptions do we have of this guy here? Yeah, super strong. Nobody could subdue the guy. How had they tried subduing him? Chains and shackles, and he kept breaking. So I imagine that he's got like the cuffs around him with the chains kind of hanging there. What else would he have looked like? Very frightening. What would be frightening about the guy?
Dirty, unshaven, unkempt.
Right. Would he have like cuts all over his body too, probably from all the gashes? Like you'd see like things on his arms and all this sort of thing. If you were to see somebody like that, like what this society was doing was, let's seclude the guy. Like, let's get him to live in the tombs. We don't want him to be around us. Do you suppose that people that have kind of a scary appearance can experience seclusion quite a bit? I remember, so whenever I was, like, getting the gospel taught to me, I used to wear, death metal t-shirts, and I had headphones around my neck all the time. My sideburns were down to here. And the girl that taught me the gospel said afterwards, when I first met you, I thought you were going to kill me. And so that was my appearance. And there were somebody that was actually still willing to talk to me about God. Did you have a comment, LR?
It's just interesting that you'll have people that kind of wonder if they could be saved because they've done so much evil, right?
Right.
I mean, we meet people like that. This is our poster child right here.
Yes.
And it's interesting that we see him like this, and you can compare him to Samson with the strength, but you see Samson in the end has faith to go on, and this man, after these demons are cast out of him, discovers faith. So this is our poster child for conversion.
Right. And so let's say that this guy gets converted. He still has these permanent scars on him. Do you think, let's just say that there was a church. There wasn't in this area, but let's just say. Do you think all the Christians pretending would have been totally okay bringing this guy into the church? Do you think there'd be any look at all those scars on him. And he just kind of, we know a lot about this guy and what he's done. What if there was somebody in this community that had a history of lots of things and they had tattoos all over their arms and stuff like that? Would we be careful about what we said in Bible classes about things like that? Would we be sensitive to the background of people who have become Christians and learn to accept them and embrace them and challenge them where they need to be challenged, obviously? But if a local church is going to be involved in reaching people that come from very frightening kinds of backgrounds, there's got to be a degree of learning how to accept people that have very big cultural background differences than we do. Yeah.
The very thing you don't want to do, in my mind, is if you're trying to change someone, you don't want to start out pointing out their wrong.
Right.
You need to ease into that.
Well, and when it comes to the scars and stuff, there's nothing inherently wrong about that. So there might be things that we don't like because they're not part of my cultural sensitivity or whatever. That we got to be careful about that kind of stuff. So, any other comments about that? Yeah, Wes?
If we were to bring that up, it might be a point of shame for them that at one point in their life they got this mark on their body because of something they did or a problem. We don't remember that we also have scars and tattoos inside ourselves.
Right.
That we've done. We have that shame.
Right.
So it's just a physical representation.
And there's a story behind these things. So I know a girl that was raped and molested several times. And on her body, she got a tattoo that had the titles of what God says about her, that I'm loved and I'm forgiven and I'm redeemed and all these things. Who wants to criticize that? Anybody want to go up to her and criticize that? You don't know the story behind that. You don't know the story behind all these gashes in this guy. There's got to be a getting to know each other and learning to forbear with things that maybe we don't understand all the time. And if they're in sin in some way, challenge it. Yeah.
I think this is important to talk about, and I like that you just said if there's sin, some way challenge it, because I think the story is interesting about the calming the sea, because Jesus doesn't rebuke the waves; he rebukes the wind.
Yep.
Which is the cause of the waves.
Right.
So when we learn to rebuke people, and we need to learn how to not view people through our eyes, we need to learn how to view them through love of Jesus' eyes, and when we reach that point of having to rebuke the sin or the wind behind the problem, then we learn how to do it with love.
Right.
And then we can create people that want to follow Jesus.
Right. Yep, good. All right, so as we continue in the story then, a couple other points to make here. One minor point, this isn't the main point of the story, but this guy was given like the kind of strength that people go to. What's that like place that you work out that was almost cult-like a few years ago? People did it all the time. CrossFit. If you're in it, I'm not saying it's a cult, but it was just, people were just really crazy about it. Like, people would go to all these things and, like try to get really strong. This guy's got the kind of strength that people work out for, like, hours a week. But that strength is being used to harm himself. Could Satan ever push strength on somebody that could end up being used to their own destruction? I want political strength. It might kill you. I want financial strength. It might kill you. I want popularity. That might kill you too. Could Satan kind of inhibit and encourage that kind of thing in the lives of people? In this case, this guy's got all kinds of strength and it's killing him. It reminds me, remember in the story of Elijah, where the people are, the Gentiles are gashing themselves, cutting themselves, trying to invoke the gods to do something? Reminds me a little bit of that guy. But look at the healing then. Look at verses 6 through 13. And when he saw Jesus from afar, he ran and fell down before him. And crying out with a loud voice, he said, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I adjure you by God, do not torment me." For he was saying to him, "Come out of the man, you unclean spirit." And Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" He replied, "My name is Legion, for we are many." And he begged him earnestly not to send them out of the country. Now a great herd of pigs was feeding there on a hillside, and they begged him, saying, "Send us to the pigs, let us enter them." So he gave them permission, and the unclean spirits came out and entered the pigs, and the herd, numbering about 2,000, rushed down the steep bank into the sea and drowned in the sea. There's so much going on here. So I don't know how to answer the question of, like, is Jesus interacting with the demon or the man? It seems like they kind of get, like, blurred together. That's a discussion that I just don't know all the answers to that. But what is this demon afraid of? Of being tormented. All right, so how would a demon be tormented? What would be torment for a demon?
Hell.
So what is this demon afraid of? Matthew 25, what was hell created for? The devil and his angels, or his demons. So when this demon, like, imagine, like, "Don't torment me, don't torment me," and what he's saying, "Don't cast me into hell." Have you ever had this conception before that hell is going to be this place where demons are having, like, a nice barbecue, and it's, like, nice for them, and it's bad for all the people that are there? Do demons know more about hell than you? Yes, they know a lot more about it than I do. And they're scared to go there. Do we have that same kind of sober fear of going there? There might be something that, I mean, they might have insight that that we need to learn from. But what does this demon address Jesus as? This is interesting, because this is not what the demon in chapter 1 addressed Jesus as. What does he call him? What verse is it? Son of the Most High God. Okay, this is interesting. In Mark chapter 1, the story that we didn't look at because of me having COVID, the demon says to him in chapter 1, what does he call him? Yeah, the Holy One of God in chapter 1, verse 24. So that demon calls him the Holy One of God. This demon calls him Son of the Most High God. Anybody know what that term was used for in the Old Testament? It's used in a couple places, most notably in the book of Daniel. But God Most High was used in contexts of God being ruler over all the nations. The book of Daniel, a book where they're in exile, God is the God Most High over all the nations. What kind of region is Jesus in right here? Gentile region. So it's interesting that maybe it's a Gentile demon, I don't know. they're all Gentiles, I guess. I don't know. All right. He says, Jesus asks the guy, what is your name? When do you think the last time anybody asked that guy that question was? Like every time, like he was like out in the mountains and like kids are trying to go to bed in your house and they hear this, that crazy guy screaming on the mountains again. Like that guy, that guy, that guy. When did anybody ever like, hey, what's your name? Look at when Jesus is interacting with the guy, like he's actually like wanting to personally know the guy. So the demon, I think, answers, what is his name? Legion, for we are many. So it seems like there's a lot of demons in this guy, or maybe he's referring to all the demons, like we're kind of a big army. The word legion is a military term that means about 6,000 soldiers. All right, so what's ironic about what happens to this army? What happens to it? Yeah, so the army gets drowned in the water right after Jesus saves his disciples from drowning, so that's interesting. But can you think of any other stories in the Bible where an army is drowned? The Red Sea. So it's almost like there's like this new exodus that's happening. The greater Pharaoh is Satan and his demons, and Jesus has come to give deliverance from that sort of thing. One other, so that's just kind of a cool echo of Old Testament kind of imagery. Sometimes we think Pharaoh might be those people in Washington, D.C., but the real Pharaoh is Satan and his demons. That's what you have to be most scared of, and that's what Jesus came to give deliverance from. But one minor lesson from this, how many pigs are killed to save this one guy? 2,000. So is one person worth more than 2,000 pigs? Yeah, but 2,000 pigs are worth like $500,000. Okay, well, how about this? Is one person worth more than 2,000 really cute puppies? Well, I'm not getting many yeses on that one. This story, have you ever known people that spend way more time helping animals than helping other people know the Lord? Do you suppose that we could have our priorities mixed up? Our culture's become more and more obsessed with pets and dogs, and I'm not saying it's wrong to have any of those kinds of things. Yeah, yeah. So this story should say something about that. I remember when I taught this to a group of junior high kids, and I did the whole thing. Is one person worth more than 2,000 pigs? Yeah, yeah, pigs are kind of gross. What about puppies? Oh, we think the answer is yes, but we're not sure. all right, so with this, there's no lost cause with Jesus. Jesus is going to do something better than shackle the guy. The best society can do is shackle him and put him in a room with crazy people. But Jesus interacts with the guy and actually transforms him. There's like a lot of self-help books that'll tell you, here's how you control this thing that you do. Here's how you shackle yourself. But you don't ever get transformed from the inside out. And this is exactly what Jesus does to him. We don't have enough time, really, so we're not going to read the rest of the text, but the reaction of the town in verses 14 through 17, this guy ends up being clothed and in his right mind. I'll never forget when I was training with Barry Kircheville, he preached a sermon on this text, and he was like, all right, this guy's clothed and in his right mind. If you're walking around unclothed, what does that mean about you? You're not in your right mind. Now, that's not the point of the story, but it's just funny that it's worded that way. Clothed and in his right mind. And then these people are begging Jesus to leave. I don't know if they're scared of something worse. I don't know if they're upset about the financial losses that Jesus brought upon them by having these pigs be killed in this situation. But the reaction then of the man himself. He's sent back to his hometown, and he's told, tell everybody how much the Lord has done for you. Now, this is an interesting thing. Jesus tells this guy, you go tell. He tells the guy that had leprosy at the end of chapter 1, you be quiet. He tells other people, you be quiet. Why does he tell this guy to talk? Any ideas? This is a Gentile region. So if it's a Gentile region and the news starts spreading among the Gentiles, will that be as threatening to Jesus' ministry? No, because Jews and Gentiles don't talk to each other. So if the Gentiles start figuring some of this out, then that's going to be a fine thing. So there's a sense in which this is the first apostle to the Gentiles. He's sent to this region. Anybody know what happens next time Jesus is in this area? Oh, this is so cool. All right, so the next time Jesus is here, look at, go over to chapter 7 and look at verses 31 and 32. It says, then he returned from the region of Tyre and went through Sidon to the Sea of Galilee in the region of Decapolis. This is the same area. And it says, and they, plural, they brought to him a man who was deaf and had a speech impediment, and they begged him to lay his hands on him. So next time Jesus comes to this same region, there's a crowd of people flocking to Jesus. And all we know is that this one guy, Luke's account or Matthew's account says it was actually two demon-possessed guys that he healed. So all we know is that there's like two guys that were sent back into this area to go tell everybody. Next time Jesus comes back, there's a big crowd. What do we deduce from that? They told. They went and they told everybody what the Lord had done for them. Can you tell people what the Lord has done for you? When we think about, like, I want to start doing evangelism workshops every, like, 3 months on a Saturday. And one of the unfortunate things about evangelism workshops is not many people come to them because they think that if we're going to do an evangelism workshop, well, my gift is not teaching, so I'm not going to go to that. That's not going to be the purpose of those workshops, by the way, whenever we start doing those, because everybody's got some part to play in evangelism. But we can all tell people what the Lord has done for you, for us. If you can't articulate what the Lord has done for you, how well have you digested it yourself? So, any comments or questions on that story? Yeah. What? Huh? Well, yeah, you.
There is one aspect of this account that I've always found interesting.
What's that?
The pigs drown.
Yeah.
Such that they are buoyant.
They're
excellent swimmers. They don't drown. They float.
Wow. I did not know
so
that.
So for the pigs to actually drown in the sea is somewhat miraculous in nature.
Wow. Do you have like a pig farm?
No, but I grew up around a lot of farms.
Oh, that's cool. This is one of the benefits of moving to a more rural place. You get good insight like that I've never heard before. Thank you. All right. Yeah. Huh? It's a big balloon? Oh, all right. I'll never forget it now. Except in this story, they're a popped balloon. All right. We don't have much time for this next section, but you've got this story. It's another sandwich scene where you've got two stories, and it gets interrupted. You start the first story, it gets interrupted by its own complete story, then you finish it out. So you've got Jairus, who's this synagogue ruler. He comes to Jesus. His daughter is not doing well. This woman who's been bleeding for 12 years, and she touches Jesus, and Jesus goes, "Who touched me?" And the disciples are like, "There's a bunch of people touching you. What are you talking about?" And then this woman confesses that she had touched Jesus, and she had been healed. You come back to Jairus, who's got this daughter that's about to die. By the way, Jesus' triage work is not very good. This woman's been bleeding for 12 years, and she interrupts this whole thing about going to this girl that's about to die. And when I say his triage work is not very good, I mean that tongue in cheek. Like, death does not stop his ability to help people. So it seems like he's missing an emergency, but nothing is outside of Jesus' ability to heal people. So you've got that going on. He comes back to the girl. She's died now. All right. As we've said before, one of the purposes of these sandwich stories is to see the differences and the similarities. The differences between Jairus and the woman. The man is a man and the woman's a woman. Did that matter in that society? Yes, it did. One of them is named and the other one is unnamed. So Jairus is named. The woman is just a woman. How does the man approach Jesus? Face to face. She has to sneak up behind him. Jairus has got a house that the daughter's going to be healed in. And she spent all of her money on physicians who couldn't help her. How old was the daughter that died in the text? She's 12. How many years had this woman been bleeding? 12 years. So he's had 12 years of joy in life with this daughter, and she's had 12 years of misery. So they seem like the most opposite people you could ever imagine. But what are the similarities? Both the woman and the girl have uncleanness because she's died now. The girl has died. Both Jairus and the woman fall at Jesus' feet in 22 and 33, and both reached out in faith. There's a crowd of people, and Jesus goes, "Who touched me?" A crowd of people, and only one is reaching out by faith. But one point to make from this story is that we carve people up politically, skin color, socioeconomic, education, whatever. There's vast differences between people. The one thing that matters is that we all need to bow down to Jesus, and we've got problems that only Jesus can solve. That's what unites everybody in Christ, no matter who you are. So, all right, thanks for the good discussion. It was fun to do this with you guys.